Well, hi everyone, and welcome to Designers for Learning. This is our fourth on-air webcast, and today is March 25th, 2013, and I am very happy and excited to introduce my guest, Dr. Molly Duggan. And do you want to go ahead and give a quick bio of where you're teaching now and kind of fill in everybody on how we know each other, and and we'll go from there.
I'd be happy to, Jennifer. I'm Dr. Molly Duggan, and I'm currently the director of the Master of Arts in Community College Administration program at Lenoir Rhine University, and we're currently located in Asheville, North Carolina. And I've been working with distance learning and technology, or at least teaching via technology, for 12 years. And before that, I was teaching distance-based courses that were probably comparable to, maybe correspondence courses, some interesting things like that, really early distance learning before people were really calling that, involved with Blackboard when it first started. So quite a bit of time spent with working at a distance.
Which is a perfect segue to introduce how we know each other. Dr. Duggan was my qualitative research professor, and as she mentioned, I took the course as a distance student. And so when I started exploring these ideas of practical learning opportunities, applied learning, even getting into some of the service learning stuff we've been talking about in other previous webcasts, I certainly wanted to talk to her because in our class, one of the requirements was to create a project in which we didn't just learn about qualitative research by reading about it and taking some quizzes, or as you hear about what people are doing these days with online learning, where all it takes, right, is to watch a video and take a quiz, and then you know how to do it. I say sarcastically. Dr. Duggan takes a very different approach and throws you into the mess, and is there as a great guide on the side to help steer me when I would get stuck, and give me great ideas on ways to frame my project from the outset. And that's really what I want to talk to her about today is, and as I said sarcastically, I see where some people are heading with online learning and distance education, and it's somewhat troubling to me when I watch some of it. And so I like to talk to folks who I think are doing some cool things and maybe would point us in a better and more maybe productive area from an instructional design standpoint. So why don't you just tell us a little bit about, in general, your philosophy. Why, for example, in my qualitative research class, was it important for you as the instructor to give us a project-based assignment that was very authentic and very much driven by our research interests and goals?
Well, thank you, Jennifer. One of the reasons why I designed that particular type of assignment is I don't feel you can learn a topic until you immerse yourself in it. And just reading how to do interviews, how to collect data, how to analyze it, just reading how other people do it, first off, is boring. Mm-hmm. Just outright boring to read what everybody else does. But to get in there and figure out what to do and what your own personal techniques are. With qualitative research, everyone does it a little differently. And you can't really train someone to do that type of research by just having them read. You have to have them do it. So the challenge for that class was to help students create a small enough project that it could be done in less than a semester. And with that particular course, for those of you who may not be as familiar with this type of learning, what I did was each week they did another component of the research. So one week we would be reading about interviews and they would have to go out and do interviews. And another week we would be reading about doing notes and they would have to do that. So it's figuring out how to integrate all of this and how to allow folks to have the actual experiences. And it's different when everyone's at a distance. And this particular course that I taught was video streamed and it was offered through satellite delivery. So I didn't, in some cases, I did not see all the students. I did not see Jennifer, I think, until we started video conferencing when I was meeting with some of the students outside of class. And I had students in there across the nation that I never saw. And all I would hear would be little voices in class. Right. I'd ask a question, wait, and little voices. And so you really need to work individually with folks with that, but help them focus the assignments down. And I think that's one of the issues with any distance-based course is it's so tempting to give a project, a full project that you know is just perfect, but you have to break it down into small enough bits that it can be done in a logical way that won't overwhelm the student and overwhelm you, because you've, as the instructor, it's not just one project you're overseeing, but maybe 20 or 30.
And that's really what I find so fascinating and actually understandable. I understand why people are excited by this whole idea of posting a video and then having students take a quiz, because there's a lot of upfront work, obviously, mm-hmm. to get the content developed, and even putting quizzes together and having something there where you're assessing something that may be important and relevant to the topic. But the way you do it, and now I've actually borrowed many of your techniques.
Oh,
and
good.
In fact, one of my students just popped in the chat room, so hopefully she thinks it's working well. But this whole idea where it's very student-directed from the get-go, and if I recall correctly in your class, and I've asked my students to do the same, we actually had a meeting where, I don't even remember if we had a face-to-face or if it was just a series of emails, where you wanted to know the parameters of the project mm-hmm. we wanted to work on, and then you use that as a way to help me frame, as you're saying, can this be completed in 16 weeks? And is this part of the scope of what we're trying to talk about in the program or in the course? So can you kind of talk about that process and how time-consuming that is for your time? Mm. Because you're setting up all these separate little meetings and kind of getting in the heads of the student when you really don't know them very well. So can you explain how that usually works?
Yeah, that is extremely time-consuming. And thank you for noticing. Because I don't think students often realize how much time goes into teaching a distance course.
Right.
It's so much easier to just walk into a classroom, talk, put up a quick PowerPoint to guide you, and you know, talk with students face-to-face, meet with them. But at a distance, and when you don't really get to see the person to connect with them, I have to take copious notes. So we were using Adobe Connect, and Adobe Connect gave me that wonderful option of a chat with a notebook, a kind of noteboard, and I would type everything in there and save it. Mm-hmm. And then I would save it and make a note in my calendar that Jennifer was number 23.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I would meet with Jennifer again that morning, I'd go through my calendar to say, okay, I'm meeting with all these students. I pull up number 23 for Jennifer. I pull up 14 for John. I pull up 36 for George. And so I would save these chats where I had taken notes, because there were so many things going on. It was the only way I could keep them straight. And if I kept it on just regular pieces of paper, I never had them with me, but they were always there with Adobe Connect. So I think part of that is to allow the student to choose a topic that interests them, because I could choose a topic and it would be of interest to me, but it may not interest the student. So encouraging them to find something that's of interest but is appropriate for that task. And not every topic, for example, is appropriate for qualitative research. And again, in that course, I was getting people to the point where hopefully they were thinking about dissertations and what types of data they may want to gather for their dissertation. So this was a chance for many people to continue to work on their literature review component as well. So it's trying to figure out how to help them move through a topic that was of interest to them, how to take that and focus it to where we could collect data in one of three ways, well, in three different ways out of several, and then how to make sense of that, how to manage it. So I had to manage myself and manage all of the students. And that class was usually a large one where I would average around 20 students, each doing something totally different. And some students I knew because they were students from my program, and some students I never met. So it was, there was a lot of balancing and a lot of time spent working individually with folks. And sometimes those video conferences would be 15 minutes. Sometimes they'd be an hour, hour and a half to help them focus down. Some students needed to meet twice a week, some every other week.
So I've got one of my students is listening to us right now, so I'm kind of interested to hear if she can see and sense any parallels to what we're doing. But for our class, I actually had the students the first weeks develop a course contract with me, mm-hmm. Which helped to accomplish that. And I did ask everybody to meet with me either on Skype or, as you did, in Adobe mm-hmm. Connect. And then in our class, they're actually working with real clients in design and an instructional design product. So the subject matter is different, the premise is the same. And so then there's that component, working with the student one-on-one, but then we're also sending them out in the real world, as you did with us. We were interviewing folks, we were observing people. So how much, for lack of a better way to say it right now, how much rope did you give students in terms of the context they were going in? Did you just kind of let everybody go about it, or were there certain things that would have concerned you as far as maybe getting them in over their heads in some settings?
And it is according to the setting. And I think what you were doing, you knew more about than I did, mm-hmm. because your topic that you decided to work with was Twitter. Mm-hmm. And whereas I had a Twitter account that my daughter had said, oh, you must Twitter. You must tweet. You must learn how to tweet. And I said, okay. Why? She said, because I do it. I said, okay. So in some cases, the students knew more about the arena than I did. But if they were doing their research in an educational institution, there are certain steps they had to take because of ethics. And it's not that other studies don't require ethics. It's just different steps had to be taken. So in some instances, it was guiding the student to figure out, well, who should they speak with at their site to get permission to go in and interview, or to get permission to observe, or to locate students? What are the steps? And some folks knew immediately who to contact, and others I had to email them through it, video conference them through it. In some cases, I ended up calling an institution or two for them and kind of opening the doors.
Okay, so this is actually, and I'm sorry if anyone perceives that I'm jumping around, I'm trying to kind of go from beginning to end, but this is a great point. So I happen to be working with a group of very mature students, most of them working professionals, so they either found an opportunity through work or a volunteer organization they're working with. So I was making a big assumption they were able to handle that. So you mentioned you needed to step in. If you were doing this, say, with an undergrad class or someone with less experience, do you think it is the responsibility, is that an important part of the process for the student to actually take the initiative to go out and do it? And at what point did you decide to step in and say, oops, this looks like it's not working, I need to step in and help them find a client or, for your case, a research subject?
And I think it does matter if you're talking about undergraduate students, master level, or doctoral students. And with the doctoral students, by golly, they should be able to go out and do it. And if they can't, because they just don't know who to contact, I can help them and point them toward the right person, but they'd still need to make that initial contact. Although there were some people I worked with and helped them craft an email of introduction that they sent. But some people needed a lot of attention that way and a lot of support, whereas others were comfortable with just walking down the hall and talking with them. With master's level students, it seems to be a split. Some are very comfortable and automatically know. Some do not. I think one of the issues there is if you're doing the research or the assignment at your home institution. Mm-hmm. I have some students who are not currently in a community college. And so when they have an assignment to interview faculty members, in transfer courses and in vocational technical courses. They've got a list of questions I've given them, and they're supposed to compare responses and look for trends. They sometimes need a little more assistance getting in because they aren't already there. So sometimes I have to guide them a little toward that. I'd still want them to make the initial contact. But that's kind of tough because some students, if they say the wrong thing from the very beginning, they've just messed up the next 2 years worth of being able to use that site. So you really have to rely, I think, on your gut to figure out who needs what help.
Yeah, and getting back to the whole idea, underlying premise here, that these are online and distance students, and as you said, when I took the class, I don't even think you heard my voice because I think the way I interfaced with the online learning system, I only was allowed to use text chat, which I think we've evolved from that, fortunately. But then you can't read my face. You don't know if I'm sitting there reading another book or I've got, you know, my headset on listening to music. So, you know, when you talk about that, you go by your gut, what signals are you looking for? Like, I personally, I'm kind of leading the witness here a little bit, I look for silence. And when I haven't heard anything, then I get very, very nervous. It's not the ones that are sending me emails and asking me questions all the time. It's the ones I don't hear from. And so I'm just curious how you manage that in an online and a distance setting.
That's a key to me, that silence. When they don't speak or I haven't had an email from them, I institute a chat of some kind, even if it's just a checking in email. Hey, haven't heard from you in a while. Let's chat about how things are going in class. And I've actually started scheduling more of those. I kind of work them into my syllabus now where every other week I try to schedule it as students meet with me during that week. But if we've got an off time and I'm concerned about the student because I know that they're usually right up with things and all's going well and then they've fallen between the cracks or I'm just not hearing from them, I don't let them slide by. If I haven't heard in a week, I jump right in and say, hey, let's chat. I've missed hearing from you. You know, I'd like an update. Or I've had this really cool idea that I may not have really had, but I tell them I've had this really cool idea about their project and I'd like to run it by them. When are you available for a chat? And usually that's enough to kind of stir them on to respond.
And I, like I said, I'm joking with Felina here, who's from in my class, but I also this semester have more than encouraged, made it actually part of the grade for the course, for the students to maintain a project management blog, which to me serves a couple purposes. Mm-hmm. One is for me to be able to see how things are going, and that's kind of the administrative piece of it, but also the kind of the reflective practice for them. So I very much within the rubric tried to make it the requirement be just kind of do a head dump once a week where you're going, okay, here's who I've spoken with, here's who I need to speak with, this is going well, if I could do this again, this is what I would do. And I can't say at all they've embraced it. I think it's really been a requirement that they consider, which maybe that's a good part of learning. Learning's not always supposed to be an easy process, but it's certainly nothing that they have as a group just rushed to. And I also thought there might have been more cross between, you know, peer-to-peer interaction and a little bit, you know, folks are giving a few suggestions, but I guess it's not necessarily a community space where people are using it as a typical blog where you're reflecting and then people are commenting. So have you ever tried anything like that where you get the students to do something on a more formalized basis?
I do a blend. I have found, especially if it's a research course, I like them to keep what I call the researcher journal. And they're to write in there everything they do, every change they make, everything that, even if they get this thought of, oh, I really wish I could interview so-and-so. Fantastic. Write it down in that journal. And I encourage them to do that, but that's not what they share.
Okay.
That is what they do to kind of keep themselves straight because we have all these wonderful ideas and then we say, yes, yes, I'll remember that. And then at the end of the semester or 2 weeks later even, we go, now what was that? There was someone else I wanted to interview and I just don't remember who that was. Whereas if I have kept up with my journal, then I can go back and read through that and go, yes, that's who it was and why. Okay, yeah, I'll do that, but I think I'll also add this. So I'll have that as a private assignment, and we're currently using Sakai, and our version of that is LAMP, but within there, it has a blog function that I've renamed a journal, and they're able to set those as private, where only they can read and I can read.
Okay.
So that they will do entries every week, and I'll make comments on those so that I'm up on what's happening, but no one else can read those.
Okay.
Then in the discussion forums, what I'll do is maybe ask a broad question of, at this point in the semester, students typically run into one of these three issues. And so what of these have erupted for you? How have you handled them? If you haven't had to deal with those, what suggestions would you have, or what issues have popped up for you, and get them discussing that way. So I do one part that's private and one that's public, and then I can give them feedback immediately on the private one.
And that comes up a lot. And in fact, I'm kind of responding over in the text chat. Peggy was asking me about if I was saying project management blog or log, and I was saying blog. And I know 6 years ago when I was in my master's program at Indiana University, blogs were new, and so there was this huge push for everybody to post everything publicly on the open internet on a blog. And I did that, and I have thousands of posts that I would make, and I got into it. Other students don't. And so it really begs the question, to me anyway, should these be private, or should they be public, or should, again, it be up to the student to decide? And so I made the decision in this class to keep it private within the context of our walled garden of our class and Blackboard, so it's not open to the open internet. But I didn't take that next step, maybe giving them the opportunity to say, would you like it just to be between the two of us, the student and myself? And maybe that's something to consider in terms of maybe they'd be a little bit, because they are learning new skills, and sometimes, well, a lot of times, you don't want to show how much you don't know about the material by sharing it with the world. So that's a good point. And then kind of skipping back to the whole benefits of doing an applied learning. I don't know. What do you call this? Do you have a word for what this is?
I call it performance-based learning.
There you go.
That's my term.
I'm generating quite a laundry list. Everyone calls it something different depending on the – in fact, my first or second session was with a woman who called it service learning, because that made sense in what she was doing. Beth called it applied learning. So in performance-based learning. Another thing I thought was great in your course, you really encouraged us to use this as an example of, for example, a portfolio, but even taking it to the next level. You really wanted us to see us get these published, and so I did submit it to a conference, and it was accepted, and so that was a check mark for my requirements within the doctoral program. But how much does that play into it, that there's an end game for the student beyond just the walls, the 16 weeks of the course?
Well, and there's several end games for that, and if I can kind of jump to, Peggy made a comment about it's sometimes tricky to know how much help is too much and when you're enabling the helplessness. I think that gets into some of the end game. How do you figure out what the student needs to progress? And so sometimes what they get out of your course has nothing to do with what you were really teaching, but something else. One of the issues with that course in particular was that I wanted them to come out of that knowing enough about qualitative research that they could decide, do I want to use this for my dissertation or do I not? And that was one thing. If I have done this and I'm interested in it, is this something, can I take what I started in this class and expand it for my dissertation? One of my students, for example, and I don't remember if she was in your class or not, but she ended up doing the pilot study for her dissertation in that class. And she published that, presented on it, and took what she did from that as the pilot and added to it and changed her protocols and her observations and then expanded it out to her entire institution. So to me, it needs to go beyond just a classroom assignment, but should be something that will help them especially for doctoral students and master's students, give them something they can use later. So it can go in a portfolio. It can help them get recognition nationally, because eventually everybody's searching for jobs. And part of that is to get our name out there. And as you become more comfortable in these professional arenas, you get better known and you've got publications and it, you know, hey, I got a pub and I'm just a student.
Hey, it's on my Vita. I put it on there. It's still there. Mm-hmm. And so that, to me, it's been worth a lot for that very reason. And I've got one of the first Twitter studies that was out there.
Yes.
5 years ago or whatever it was. So before we kind of leave this example of my particular classroom example, I just had a question from the student's perspective. I guess it would be your perspective of the student's perspective. But do you think they go, oh my gosh, why is she making us do all this busy work? Why doesn't she just tell us what we need to know and test us at the end of the semester and at midterms? So this is just different, in my opinion. I know it's not, you're not the only one who's doing something like this, but certainly you'd be more the exception than the norm, I think. So from a student's perspective, what are their reactions when you lay this out in a syllabus that this is how the semester is going to run?
They groan. They complain. They send emails within the first week that says, well, you know, I really can't do this, and I don't have access to that, and I can't do this other. And they're scared.
Right.
They're scared because it's different. They have become accustomed to, all right, read the chapter and a quiz, or read the chapter and an assignment. They're used to that. They're comfortable with it. Performance-based learning, service learning requires change. And people don't always like to change. And it's tough on the faculty member, too, when they try to do something different. And you know, the students, because it is so different, and I try to be very conscious of student time.
Yeah, that's a huge, you know, I said it was going to be my last question, but I think there may be a couple more along this line. We talked a little bit about your time, but how do you help manage that? So you are, you know, there's an expectation a 3-credit course is going to take a student so much time per week. How do you kind of manage that as well?
Well, and one of the things I try to do early on, especially with that particular assignment, was try to make the assignments to be something that they can do in their workplace while they are working. So my goal is for them to be able to work on my homework at their desk in their office.
And it looks like they're doing, like they are doing something.
They are.
They are doing something.
Because, for example, one of the students in the qualitative research course was looking at homeschoolers in his community college. And he was in student development, and he had to interview and, you know, do some data collection. So he was able to bring students into his office. He was able to identify who was homeschooled and who wasn't. So he could bring them into his office and work with them with student activities and a variety of other things. So he was able to work all of that in as part of his normal duties. A course that I taught this past fall on budget and finance at the community college, and you want to talk about people who groan when they start out in a class, imagine if it's all budget and money. They go, oh. But one of the things that they had to do was a focus group with students to get some of their perspective on finance and budget and money and the impact and student input and all of this. And I said, while you're doing this, let's craft some questions that you could use in this focus group that would help you do a better job of what you do. And he was in IT, so we crafted some questions where he could then find out about student perception of helpfulness of IT staff, what were their needs, things like this, so that he could go to his supervisor and say, okay, here's the deal. I'm doing this assignment for a master's degree program I'm in, but the professor is allowing me to also add in these questions that I can use for work. What are your thoughts? What would you like me to find out?
Right.
Get their buy-in so that they know you are doing something for them.
Okay.
And so that's, you know, part of it. It's teaching them how to do the politics, how to get the buy-in of their colleagues and supervisors so that they can get support there.
Yeah, that's we have a few doing the exact same thing where they're working with something at work, except that was a little different in my case because part of mine was also laying out the scope of a project, coming to a client with some type of understanding of a problem or an opportunity or a need and kind of working with them to define it. And I didn't want it to be something that had already been assigned at work, you know, because then they would have skipped that portion of the skill set. I wanted them to kind of come up with what a potential problem may be or an opportunity mm-hmm. or a need. But so that is a little bit different. But yeah, definitely we have some folks working definitely with work projects. All right, so enough about me in my classes, unless you want to mention it. But I also wanted to make sure you had the opportunity to talk about you switched universities, and mm-hmm. obviously you were at Old Dominion. And so now as you're moving into this new area, and you have what, a mix of both face-to-face and distance students, is that right? Is that how you characterize it?
This program started in the fall as hybrid with face-to-face and online, and then about a month and a half ago, I was told I'm going fully online.
Oh, okay. So you are online, okay.
Yes, and the hybrid part, my students really liked being able to come together face-to-face. But, you know, you recruit for programs and you have to expand because we always want more students to replace those who graduate. So looking at that and looking at who would benefit the most by the degree, one of the things we've had to deal with is, well, how do we have folks at a distance and give them that face-to-face feel?
Mm-hmm.
And make sure that they get to interact with each other because you can interact in forums and blogs and discussions and things like this, but sometimes that face-to-face part is really hard to replace. So at the moment, what we're doing is one weekend a semester, one Friday night and one Saturday, folks come to campus, and so they get to stay overnight in beautiful Asheville, North Carolina.
Mm-hmm. That sounds good to me.
Yeah, gorgeous leaves. It's nice and cool in the summer. In the winter, we get a lot of snow scares. It was snowing this morning, but it doesn't seem to last long here. Not like Chicago area where I think it starts snowing in October and stops in May. So what I've started to do is that. And so Friday afternoons from 5 until 9, we do programs. Things. We do advising. We work on the curriculum because I have my students advise me on curriculum.
Okay.
You know, what are you seeing is useful? What has worked well for you? What hasn't worked well? And I will ask them to take the curriculum and show it to supervisors where they are and get their input. And I talk to people. So we use that Friday night. We order supper and have it delivered to us, and we work on the program. Mm-hmm. And then that Saturday, we do a series of workshops or presentations where I bring speakers in from across the nation. They'll either come in through WebEx, they'll video conference in, or sometimes they'll come here because they can't resist Asheville. And we'll have workshops. And I like that approach as we expand and we have more folks from further away who aren't comfortable or able to come in for a weekend, that I'll video conference them in so that they'll be a part of this. But it's that networking. They need to meet these experts from across the nation who are talking about community college administration issues. And I want to make sure they have that chance. And I'm afraid if I just have these speakers do videos and then I post them, you know, we lose that chance for interaction.
And that ties in even with what we were talking before. in the class that I'm teaching now, I really think it's important to, if you work on your one project, that's great, you're really learning. But there's also something to be learned by hearing what other people are doing. And so is that also then part of what you're doing, mm-hmm. is having people, for example, if they're getting ready to do a thesis or something like that, that they have the opportunity in these sessions to outline what they're doing? Is that also
yes.
part of it?
Yes, and what I plan to do with interns, I have my first internship group this summer. They are going to be required to lead a discussion about their internship, what they learned, high points, low points, in the fall. So those who do it this summer, part of their requirements will be to lead a discussion.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And then within the internship, I think I have five or six interning at the same time this summer. And so I'll be doing a video conference. I may use Google Hangouts, where we can all meet together and they can get support from each other throughout the summer, where they get to present to each other that way. But I also want them to do a professional presentation to their colleagues in the program.
Great. Oh, got it. Okay. And so with that, you don't have to get into too much of this. I had a pre-conversation with Dr. Duggan when we talked about some of the legal issues now that she may be facing in terms of crossing state lines and having internship requirements, which is probably a different animal than doing it necessarily as a project-based, performance-based thing within a class. But let's set that aside for a minute, the legal, and is this even going to be something that you'll be able to continue, and where are we at on that? But how do you do it when you're working with the students on setting up an internship? So now we're kind of moving away from just something that they're working on and is part of a class, but then is part of a larger internship. Are the requirements similar to what you would do within a class, or are things different?
That's a good question. I have just finished within the last few weeks the internship handbook for the program, and we're going to be discussing that online later, letting my students give input. The way I'm currently structuring it is they will apply for internship and they will have to do a traditional what is it that I want to do, and kind of plan it out, objectives and that sort of thing. They will have to do two reflective papers throughout the semester, and then that professional presentation. Now, before any of that, though, I think I just get bored and have to fill every minute of my day somehow. I don't know why, but I try to help them tailor an internship to fill the gaps in their resumes.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So they send me their resume. We talk about them. We video conference about them and say, okay, so what do you think you want to be when you grow up? With some of the activities we've done, what have you enjoyed? Where do you see yourself with the ability to move up in your institution? Or are you going to have to go elsewhere? And we talk about what do they need. Some of them need to be able to fill the gap of teaching because they haven't taught before. So it may be for internship, we try to figure out a way to get them to teach because that's a gap they need to fill. Others are thinking about moving from one unit into another, so they may need fundraising experience. So for internship, then they would want to work with foundation at their institution and perhaps work on a project for them. Still others may be more IT-based but need to get a background in academics, so we move them toward maybe working with curriculum and something that way. So it really depends on the holes and what they want to do later. Now, if they have absolutely no idea what they want to do with this degree and they're really not seeing it, then I'll set them up with or help them set up a series of good old-fashioned informational interviews where they talk with various administrators around the community college and at other community colleges, because one of the things that I encourage my students to do in their networking is to see not just how their institution does ABC, but how another institution does ABC. and they'll discover that not everyone does this the same. So they may end up with a series of assignments that will help them figure out where they want to go later. So once again, it's individualized.
And so I think what I'm getting is I'm getting a headache thinking, how did she, you're right, you spend more than your waking hours. It sounds like you're probably dreaming some of this, trying to think of all the different ways you can help slot the students. But how can this possibly scale? I was talking to a friend of mine on Friday. We were talking about MOOCs and, mm-hmm. you know, how can you make them more individualized and embed some of these performance-based and applied learning principles. And it just doesn't seem like it is possible to scale beyond, say, as you're saying, you know, 20 students per instructor to try to facilitate it. So, you know, do you have a magic number, or what is the number that you could possibly take on to advise?
It depends on the assignments. With research, if you're going to be supervising all these research studies, which is kind of what you do, I would say no more than 15. Internship, I think 10 would be doable in a regular class. You know, as they get larger, I have to change assignments.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I have done is, rather than reading everyone's blogs, I have a class blog this time, and Jennifer helped me set this one up, but people have revolving roles. And I have 8 students in this one class, and rather than me reading 8 blogs each week and them having to write 8 blogs each week, they're in 4 groups. One group is the readers, and so they read the assignment for that week and post something on it on the blog, and they have to do that by Wednesday. So I just have 2 items to read there instead of 8. And then the next group of students has to respond to that by Sunday, and so I just have their 2 to read. And a third group responds with YouTube videos, links, other resources. The fourth group gets to rest. Now, mm-hmm. they're all encouraged to read the blog in between times, but that way, you know, if they miss it and they're in that group that's at rest, you know, that's okay.
Right.
Because they have a life. And so I think part of it is figuring out how can we use the technology to help us and help the students, but not overwhelm all of us. Mm-hmm. I attended a training once where undergraduate students were involved in this, and they wanted their input. And the whole idea was how we could integrate Facebook, Twitter, and all the social media into our classes. And this group of undergraduate students all wanted us to tweet about our classes, to post to Facebook about our classes, to allow them to post to Facebook about our classes, or do forums in Blackboard. You know, give them that option, but somehow we were supposed to manage all of this in our copious amounts of spare time and make sure they received credit for doing it in all these areas. And I remember sitting there going,
I'm speaking a different time. The same person I talked to on Friday, a long time ago, he had the same issue where he was encouraging students to use their own blogs and Twitter or whatever it is that they chose to use. But he actually put the onus on the student to pull back the material. So that's fine. If you want to go out there and do that, but then you better get an RSS feed that pulls back your blog posts and pulls back your Twitter feeds, and you hand it to me as almost an assignment, because I'm not going to sit there and go out and find all the little hidden places you went out on the internet and try to evaluate your participation in the entire World Wide Web. And that seemed to work for him in that case.
Well, and I think Blackboard now offers an opportunity where you can, for a forum, for example, somehow if you connect it up with Facebook and Twitter, folks can tweet or do their Facebook posting, and it's part of the forum in Blackboard.
Okay, so the feedback in there. Okay.
Yeah, I heard about that a year ago, but At Old Dominion, they weren't using that. That wasn't one of the plugins that they had purchased, and we don't use Blackboard here. I ran it past some of the master students I was teaching at that time at Old Dominion. You know, what would you say about this? Well, how would we be notified? There would be a separate pop-up that would come that only they would see, and their friends would not see that they had homework or assignments or any of that. And they said, oh, no, please, please let me keep my Facebook and my Twitter to have nothing to do with school. And I said, works for me.
I know. You do works hear for all me. The, exactly. And we've kind of gone almost full, really, I think, almost full circle on some of the Facebook stuff. I know teachers are doing some stuff successfully on Facebook, but I know, even me personally, I don't want my students, I kind of keep my Facebook really personal, not personal, I mean, you know, more people I know from almost on a social level versus more of a professional level, and I can then totally appreciate why students wouldn't want their, you know, Saturday night pictures popping up on their schoolwork. So sometimes these ideas are great, but then when you kind of think through some of the details. So I think I'm going to go through. I had a whole bunch of questions. We talked a lot about the guidance. That was a big part of my and then I guess just in general, you've talked a little bit about some of the success factors and some of the things that can get in your way. But is there anything else as far as this whole performance-based thing that you can think of that are measures of success or measures of things that maybe are red flags that things are going to go south? Is there anything you could give us as pointers in from your experience in doing this?
Usually during the first video conference I have with the student, which is why I try to do the video conference rather than an email, I know within 5 minutes what the success rate's going to be, and it gives me a much better idea then. So what I look for is commitment to the course, and you can hear that commitment in a variety of ways. Actually, you hear the non-commitment. Oh, well, you know, my books aren't here yet. Mm-hmm. Or they have a hard time scheduling. Or they can't make their technology work. Mm-hmm. For some reason, if they can't, and it's funny, but if they can't get the headset to work, for some reason, that sets them off as being at risk for the rest of the semester. And I don't know why. Because I would spend hours going through Adobe Connect with them, making sure, okay, click on this. Oh, look, you can wave. Isn't that great? All right, let's freeze your photo. And we would freeze your photo to save bandwidth. And that way, if you need to go to the bathroom, you can just do that.
Just step away. No one knows. Just,
and you're smiling, so make sure you give us a good grin. And you know, so I go through that with them to make sure they understand it. And every week they have those same problems. So those I've discovered, if they have that type of issue, they're also going to have issues as far as committing to the actual assignment. And they'll find all sorts of reasons why they can't do it and will throw up walls. And then you just have to kind of take each one down a little bit at a time.
Okay, and that's, so here's a huge, okay, this is really interesting to me. So, see, it bothers me. I want everybody committed at the same level I am, and I want...
Yes.
So this is just a personality flaw of mine, I guess. But so at what level do you just say, okay, fine, you want to perform at that level, that's your choice, you're paying the tuition, and then I'll have to evaluate you when I get your paper and it's half the requirements of what I've expected. So, I mean, how do you kind of go through that? Like at what point do you, I don't want to say you throw in the towel, but you kind of changed expectations.
Yeah. And that's a tough one because I know that when you expect students to do poorly, they will do poorly.
I know.
And when you expect them to excel, they don't only excel, they just, you know, just are perfect, just superior work. So it's that tough one. I have a couple of students now who are really having a hard time with writing. And I know they're struggling with the writing, and I'm meeting with them and I'm working with them, but you really do get to the point where you know they're either doing all they can or their job is a 60-hour week job.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
everyone's
there's only
got
so much time.
Exactly.
So you just kind of decide, okay, well, I'll mark all of these. I'll tell them where to find the information on this. I'll try to set up writing conferences when I can. And you just kind of go with that and hope they've picked out something.
Mm-hmm.
But at least that way, when you have that student again, you'll know what else to work with.
Right.
You'll already have that.
Do you think it helps then to do a lot of front-end work in terms of, okay, you've already said people are running in different directions with the nature of their projects, but there's still certain things when you go to evaluate and, or rather to assess their work, that you have a rubric in, mm-hmm. laid out with certain things that you're looking for. And
yes.
So does that then help at the time when, okay, you want to do it this way, I appreciate you're busy, whatever. But then there's going to come a day when, as you're saying, mm-hmm. I'm just going to have to say you missed the mark here and this mm-hmm. is why. Is that kind of what you fall back on then?
I do, and when I do the rubrics, I try to do them very loosely. You know, some are really tight, some are very loose. And I've even played with, well, maybe what I need is one rubric at the beginning and a different one at the end as we're kind of working through expectations. But I have found the more focused I can get them in the first week, the better off they are by far. Because otherwise they want to do everything. And the scope of the project is so huge, it's not doable. It's not doable with someone who has years of experience.
Mm-hmm.
But someone who's just learning, you know, let's break that down to a smaller part. Let's just go to this. I teach a program evaluation course, and very much like the qualitative, they have to do a program evaluation during that semester. I will help them find the program. I suggest they do a program with which they are comfortable, one from their workplace, and work them through it, and it has to be theoretically based. So they have to find a theory of program evaluation that speaks to them, which is another topic entirely, how to find a theory that speaks to you, because some theories obviously don't speak. And sometimes we have to take that theory and it's just too overwhelming and we have to focus in just one little area.
Whoops.
And I think that's it. It's seeing and then seeing just what do they need to have those skills. And some of it, is it me? You know, am I expecting too much? And I'm always dealing with that, with me.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And you know what? Felina has a question in the chat. Did you see it says, how do you counsel a student when they have reached your limit to assist them and their evaluation will reflect that? So I think she's saying that now we're getting outside of our comfort zone. I think she's saying.
So, you mean when you have had it?
I guess so.
You're right up to here. Yeah. I change my approach. And you get to that point where the student has been negative and just it seems as though the only thing they do when you're working with them is saying, well, I can't do this, and when I do this, this happens, and this is going wrong, and that is going wrong. And when I get to where I've had it, I just can't take anymore, I change my approach and flip it. And my flip for that is, well, tell me something good that happened to you in the last week.
Mm-hmm.
And they go,
I thought we were talking about my project and why it's not working. What are you talking about?
And I say, well, do you mean with life, with work, with school? I said, something good that happened, any of those arenas. And they'll come up with something. And we talk about that for a while
mm-hmm.
and get them into that. And then it's like, okay, tell me one thing you know this week about such and such project or topic, whatever, that you didn't know a month ago.
Mm-hmm.
They can always find something.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you just have to flip them to where they start thinking about the class and the topic from a positive viewpoint. And then it's at least a little more manageable for me. If nothing else, it changes the way I view them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really important. When you get to that point where you've done everything you can and you've documented everything you've done, because we haven't even gotten into the documentation part, but we do have to document. And then when it comes down to that last paper that they've turned in, well, you know, I'll thank heavens for Dragon, naturally speaking, as I dictate to the papers, saves my hands. But it may be something as simple as, you know, as we discussed in one of our other meetings, using direct quotations would really have beefed this up. It would have allowed us to hear the voices of these particular people you interviewed. And it's so important that we really start to understand what these people are like. I'm sure that the next time you have a similar assignment, you will do that. I'm going to have to take off for now.
So you're not one of those, okay, minus five, and then let them guess what it is. You've got the narrative to back it up.
Yeah, I tell them how to build the clock when it's broken.
That's great. Which, again, takes a tremendous amount of time, right? It does. It really does. And I don't know. Everyone keeps talking these days about ways to do shortcuts with technology to make the learning process more efficient and effective. And it's just this grunt work, the hard work on both sides that makes it all happen.
Cut and paste. You get to the point where you know you've told this student the same thing, and you go back to a previous paper, and you look at one of the comments, and you cut that, you paste, you know, copy it, and paste it into the next one. And I'll do something like, I think I mentioned this in paper number such and such, but in case I didn't, and then there's
and then
that comment.
Yeah. Well, you know what? We're running out of time, and I'll have one more. I hope it doesn't leave us on a downer question, and then I'll let you add any comments maybe we didn't get a chance to talk about. But as we're sending students out working on internships and working in project-based scenarios in real life, we've had it happen a couple times in my class where it's nothing, no fault of the student, no fault of mine, but the third party that they're working with has a failure of some sort. Maybe the client just decides they don't want to work anymore, or they're not interested in doing the interview they've scheduled. So how do you handle those situations where it has the potential to derail the student's project entirely, yet you don't want to just give them a free pass completely? Like, how do you help get something like that back on track?
Yeah, and that, it really depends on the project. Sometimes it might be that the institution, wherever it is they're doing their assignment, won't give them access to who they need. So we'll stop and regroup and try something else. It may be that we can find another way to get at that information. It may be that's when I can step in and ask a question and get, you know, with the people in charge and get the student access. It may be that that's just not going to work. So in order for a student to have the experience that I feel they need, if they have to learn how to do interviews, for example, I'll set them up with someone else where I have contacts and let them do that. And it may not really become part of the overall assignment, the big picture part, but it gives them that little part that they need.
So you may just have to do a little bit of at the fork in the road. You make it, okay, this project, the intent was to go off and have you do this, but we still want you to have the experience of interviewing someone, so we're going to do it as a separate little sidebar project is what you're saying. Okay.
Right.
Yeah. Because that's, it just adds stress to the process, and you know, there are inherent, it's human nature when you start working with people that things will just go south sometimes, and you just have to roll with the punches. So is there anything else on this topic that we didn't cover in terms of something, critical success factors that you think people need to contemplate that we didn't already talk about?
I think that when you're dealing with any aspect of distance learning, you have to be flexible and creative, and you have to be able to think on your feet. A student's going to present you with an issue, and it's like, well, we need to work on that. And then you have to figure out how. But it's so easy to get tied up in the bells and whistles because there's things that look really neat. So it's making sure you don't go overboard with the technology, not beyond the students, their capabilities or their even interests or desires, but can figure out a way to make it augment the learning. And I think that's tough. I like technology. I think it's fun, and I'll experiment with anything. And I try to bring it into class and get their input on it. But I also have students I'll try something out with individually first. So maybe part of that is being able to identify who are the technology, your technology savvy students that you could experiment with before exposing an entire classroom to something. Mm-hmm. And I think if you have little things like that, it will help avoid problems in a class.
Yeah, and you've kind of hinted at it here in my view of it, as far as a critical success factor. Clearly, I have objectives that I put in the syllabus. This is what mm-hmm. we're covering, and by the end of the semester, should be able to blah, blah, blah. And it's absolutely impossible for me at the outset to know how you're going to apply this in your real life. And so I think, as you mentioned a couple of times, part of our role then is also through the course of the semester is to gear our projects and our experiences mm-hmm. so that it helps them fill gaps, as you perfectly said before, fill gaps that mm-hmm. they need on their resume and their skill set. And that's very hard work. Mm-hmm. It's on both sides, the student and the teacher.
Is.
Because it's just a lot easier for them not to do that.
It wasn't like that when I was in grad school. Nobody cared.
Right, absolutely. But you know what? I went to the University of Wisconsin, and we had 450, 500 students in a class. There's no way a professor would be able to do what we're talking about here. And unless they had, I don't know, 700 TAs running around the school. So.
Mm.
Well, excellent. Thank you. Is there anything else you'd like to add? Are you good?
I'm good. Any other questions or comments?
Let's see. I think we caught all the ones that came in the mm-hmm. chat room. And thank you, by the way, to everybody that's made some commentary. If anybody's yes. listening to this right now and wants to see the text chat, if you head on over to edtechtalk.com/live/D4L, so that's the letter D, the number 4, and the letter L, you'll be able to see the text chat that was going on, and we've got some links that you may find helpful over there. But otherwise, thank you very much, and I hope you'll play along some other time when we come
yes.
up with a topic for us to talk about.
Anytime.
Excellent. Well, talk to you later. Thanks, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.